Hello and welcome to the Green Room Golf Course podcast from the British and International Golf Greenkeepers Association. Thanks for listening to this podcast, which sheds a light upon the golf industry and what it takes to maintain a modern course. I hope you enjoy the show. Hi, and welcome to this week's edition of the Green Room Golf Course podcast. We've got two interviews to bring you this week. One offers some career tips that can help you improve how you're perceived by your employers, and the second discusses an ecological visit at a golf club down in Dorset. But first up, there's a couple of announcements to make. I'm recording this introduction following the announcement that the turf pesticide acelaprin has been temporarily reauthorised for use. Although greenkeepers have moved away from chemical solutions in many cases, both out of a cultural shift and necessity as products get banned, the damage caused by chafer grubs and leather jackets and the pests that come to eat them have decimated golf courses everywhere. If you're interested in more information, head to the Bigger website and there's a link in the show notes. You may not be aware, but a couple of years ago, Bigger launched a charity that supports its members when they encounter financial difficulties in their professional and personal lives. The Bigger Benevolent Fund has already helped a number of greenkeepers get back on the right track, and we're delighted that once again our annual golf day is returning. It's a great opportunity to raise funds for the charity while having a bit of fun, and this year the event takes place at Chesterfield Golf Club. There's a link in the show notes to our website where you can find more details. I wanted to give you one final nudge with regards to the Toro Student Greenkeeper of the Year Awards, and regular listeners will have heard the little trailer that we've put together promoting the awards. Entries are due to close at the end of May, and if you're a Bigger member studying towards a relevant qualification, this is a great opportunity to make a name for yourself with one of the industry's most prestigious awards. Alongside the main award sits the Toro Young Student Greenkeeper of the Year, and that's an opportunity for any Bigger member aged 20 or under to really make a name for themselves early in their career. Finally, entries have opened for the Bigger Photographic Competition 2019. There's a brand new Apple iPad up for grabs for the winner, while the top 12 entries will be included in the Bigger Desktop Calendar 2020, which takes pride of place on course managers and head greenkeepers' desks all over the country. We're looking for photographs that really showcase how the hard work of greenkeepers enhances the environment within which their course is built. Bigger members are lucky enough to work in some of the most beautiful locations in the country, and even the world, as last year's winner Bill Wybrow proved with his picture of Royal Bled Golf Club in Slovenia. So get out there with your camera phone and start snapping. You can find details on how to enter in the show notes. This week's show kicks off with a conversation I recorded back at Continue to Learn in January with Mark Doyle, an actor who now encourages professionals to learn some of the lessons of his trade to enable them to perform better in front of an audience, such as management or your committee. Perhaps you find you've got the knowledge and the experience to do a job, but when it comes to an interview situation, nerves let you down and you don't do yourself justice. If that's the case, this is the conversation for you. There are links to the method in the show notes. We'll then follow up that conversation with a visit to Sherburn Golf Club in Dorset, where greenkeeper Ed Stant invited myself and Bigger sustainability expert, James Hutchinson, along for a course visit. There's a fascinating insight into some of the things you may not have expected to encourage or deter biological diversity, so it's worth sticking around for.
So I'm co-founder of a company called The Method. Mm-hmm. So have you heard of method acting?
Daniel Day-Lewis, that
yeah,
sort of thing.
Absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. So method acting, basically, what method acting is, it's a process that actors follow in order to consciously develop and build a role, mm-hmm. and then deliver consistently brilliant performance in that role, whatever it is that you're playing.
Okay.
So we started life 26 years ago as a theatre company, and I was an actor.
Okay.
In the theatre company. But over the past 15 years, what we've been doing is translating the method, the process that actors use to build roles, into a range of programmes to help professionals at any level consciously develop and build aspects of their role and deliver brilliant performance in their role, whatever it is that they do.
Is day-to-day working life, are we all performing day-to-day life?
Yeah, so the context is, when you go to work, you probably go to work in a particular job role. Mm-hmm. So whether that's, you know, manager, greenskeeper, receptionist, CEO, we all have a role at work. And what we do in our programs is say, let's examine the areas in that role that you would like to improve your performance. And then let's use this interesting technique that actors have developed to see if there's any way that that could unlock new ways of being exceptional at what you do.
Okay.
So it's very business focused, but you're right that the crossover is all about job performance or performance in the role that you do.
Okay.
What we're interested in doing is helping people to become exceptional at what they do. So our boast is we create star performers, but we create star performers in business or we create star professionals. And what how we do that is, what we're interested in is finding with people what are the areas of your work that you know in your heart of heart you're not exceptional.
I'm with you, Matt. Okay, yeah, I'm with you.
So once we define what's the area of work that you would like to improve in, what we have is a really interesting process to help you consciously think about how could I develop to be better in that aspect of my role.
Okay.
So, for example, I've been working with some of the guys here at Bigger this morning, and they were saying, you know, that these people are already very successful and doing brilliant work, but all of them could identify one or two scenarios where they'd like to be more confident or they'd like to be better at that aspect of their role.
Yeah.
For example, standing up in front of a group of complicated or difficult members.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Or one of them was saying, you know, I'm looking to advance my career and I have to go to lots of interviews. I want to stand out. How do I do that? So what the method does is we help people perform better in the moments of their work that they find a bit tricky.
I'm with you. What's the most important thing from your point of view of how an employee presents themselves to an employer? What's the most important thing
That's a good question. The honest truth is we would phrase it slightly differently.
Okay.
Because it's different for every employee. So the question we would ask is, where do you think you need to shine at work? And more interestingly, where are you finding that difficult? Mm-hmm. And we get the people who come on our programs to define where they need to improve. And then we say, so if you were really good here, how would you come across?
Yeah.
How would you be perceived in that situation if you were going to be super successful at your job?
Yeah.
Once people have done that and said, oh, okay, it's talking to members, that's where I need to improve my performance. And if I did that well, I would be seen as a really confident, knowledgeable professional.
Yeah.
What we then do is say, okay, well, how can our process help you authentically embody that version of you in that situation?
You can teach somebody, you know, say, go into this meeting, be confident, that sort of thing. Is there a real magic key for, like, overcoming nerves? Because you can tell them that, but actually doing it is a different thing.
Absolutely. So there is no magic key to overcome nerves. In fact, what we'd say is you don't want to get rid of feeling nervous.
Okay.
Feeling nervous is a really important integral part of you, and it's designed your fight-flight response.
Okay.
So nerves are important. You don't want to get rid of that, because if you do genuinely find yourself in a scenario where you're in danger, you want to feel nervous. So it's important to have that. Obviously, in a work context, what we want to try and do is overcome the nerves. So what actors are brilliant at is having a process that allows them to be exceptional even under incredible pressure, i.e. standing in front of an audience of 500 people who are judging their performance. What they have is a simple set of techniques that allow them to appear and feel more in control even though they're nervous. And it's really straightforward.
Is it?
Yeah.
What are the points?
So the genius of the method, and I'll give it away, is really simple. It's all about being aware of the observable behaviours that you adopt.
Yes, okay.
So there are only three different types of behaviours that you can control. So you can control how you act, and that's how you speak, how you use your body, how you use your eyes.
Yeah.
You can control what you say, how you use your language, and you can control your actions. You can control what you do to prepare yourself for difficult moments. Mm-hmm. But that's all you've got. So what we help people to do in our programs is to identify simple, observable behaviours that they can instantly put into practice to present themselves as the ideal version of them.
Okay.
So I'll give you for instance, because it's kind of a thing. So if we said you've got to stand up in front of a board and give them your plans for the next 12 months.
Yeah.
If you wanted to appear confident and knowledgeable at that point, what we'd say is somebody who appears confident and knowledgeable in that situation is likely to speak up and they're likely to look at the members in the eye. And what we'll do is try that, just focus on those two observable behaviours and see how that comes across. Then we might look at the language and say, so this is what you want to say. What words could you put in there? What would a knowledgeable person say to introduce that?
Yeah.
What would a confident person say? So we combine language and observable behaviours to help people become the best them.
That's really interesting. Yeah, it's...
Does that make sense?
It's no, it does.
Complex
yeah.
to...
It does, and it's such a simple idea. You telling me, make eye contact, say the right things. Putting it into practice is a real worry. It's a real challenge, I'm sure.
Yeah.
How do you get good at it? Is that
rehearsing
in front of a mirror, or is it just doing it? There's only one way to do it.
It doesn't have to be in front of a mirror, but the word rehearsal is really important.
Okay.
So what's amazing to us, so as I say, I started life as an actor.
Uh-huh.
What is continually astonishing to me is that in the world of business and in professional roles, people don't rehearse. Time and again, people put themselves in really stressful, difficult situations, and it's the first time they've said things out loud.
Yeah.
And obviously, coming from where I've done, there's no way, as an actor, you would put yourself on stage without having rehearsed and rehearsed and rehearsed.
Yeah.
So what we try to do in our programmes is provide not only some ideas about some behaviours that you can do, but also some safe ways of rehearsing. And it doesn't have to be at home in front of the mirror.
Okay.
It could be go and find a colleague and just run through what it is you're going to say. Try some of the language, try with a friend, try some things. It doesn't have to take long, it could be a minute or two, but it is amazing. If you practice something twice, by the third time you won't feel much more comfortable and confident in control. But it's not something that is second nature, most people do.
No, absolutely. And if you are nervous, then the tendency is actually to put it off, isn't it? Because you want to avoid it, you want to, you know, you hope it never happens. That sort of thing.
Yeah, what people tend to do is to go through things in their head, and that's valuable. There's not
that's important, but
it isn't the same as standing up and doing it and saying it out loud. So even though it feels a bit weird and uncomfortable, it's enormously beneficial. And so what we can show in our programs is just with a couple of simple behaviours, a couple of bits of practice, you can really make wildly progressive moves in the way that you come across and how you feel.
And that can have an impact on sort of how you're perceived.
One of the things that people are worried about, and it's totally natural, is that if I'm going to try something new, i.e. if I'm going to change my behaviour in an important and difficult work situation, what happens if it goes wrong?
Okay, yeah, okay.
You know, people are naturally concerned.
Yeah. You don't want to look silly.
I don't want to look
stupid.
You've
walked in wearing a suit and everybody else is wearing the golf thing. Or you've gone too far.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. The fear of going too far. Interestingly, we find the fear of... You're absolutely right. People are worried about doing too much. What that actually does is it stops you trying anything.
Okay. Yeah.
So our worry is not... whenever we work with people, it's like you don't have to worry about too much. What you have to worry about is doing anything at all.
Yeah.
That's the important thing, to try something different. So there's two laws which I'll share with you, which hopefully underpin and make sense of why this is worth trying and why it actually leads to genuine behaviour change.
Mm-hmm.
And the first law is people don't read minds, people read behaviours.
Interesting.
We don't judge people on what they're thinking.
Yeah.
What we judge people on is how they come across to us and what they say.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
So what that means is, if you're in control of how you come across and what you say, you're in control of how you're read by other people.
Uh-huh.
So the first law is people instantly see and judge behaviour. Now the issue with that is, well, if you're going to ask me to change what I'm doing, and I don't naturally do that, that's going to feel weird and it might come across wrong. So the second law is, you become your behaviour.
Okay.
So there's a direct relationship between the way you sit, the way you speak, and the words that you say, and how that makes you feel.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're standing up and introducing yourself, speaking up, looking people in the eyes, smiling and standing up, you're much more likely to feel comfortable and confident than if you're mumbling, looking at the floor, and making the shape of someone that's not comfortable. So there's two laws.
Okay.
People instantly see behaviour.
They seem quite natural. You know, they're things that I think everybody knows, aren't they?
They're not only the things people know, it's what you do. So for 90% of your time,
yeah,
and for most people, 90 to 95% of your job, you're going to be completely comfortable. And when you're at your most comfortable, you're displaying your best practice behaviour anyway.
Yeah.
Because you're confident, you're comfortable, you're in your comfort zone, you know what you're doing.
Yeah.
What's interesting is the moment you find yourself in a situation where you're suddenly not quite sure what to do, or you just don't feel very comfortable, at that point, all of the behaviours that you normally display when you're comfortable and confident can desert you.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's really only in that 5% that we're interested in saying, when it's tough, when it's difficult, at that moment, if you can control your behaviour, if you can control your language, you can present the best version of you.
Mm-hmm.
And not only will it look great, but it will help you feel more in control.
So does the old adage of imagining everybody in their underwear work?
I guess it can do for some people. I guess it depends who's in the room.
Yeah, that's true.
Honestly, if it works for you, great. I wouldn't want to stop someone doing it.
Okay, all right.
But personally, I would say no. What I would say is, if you can focus on what you're doing, and I mean really simply, in a scenario where you feel unconfident or uncomfortable, if you can hold eye contact, smile, and speak up,
mm-hmm,
in 90% of situations, if you can do those three simple things, not only will you look totally in control, but it will also help you feel more comfortable in control. And I'm not sure necessarily if people being naked around you is going to enhance that or not. So my message would be, if that helps, go for it. But don't forget to smile, look them in the eyes and speak up.
Yeah, it's a very, very simple message. But it's one that absolutely does make sense.
Yeah. And I think, if it's useful to leave, you said at the beginning of this interview, it's really hard to tell someone to be confident.
Mm-hmm.
I can tell someone to be confident till the cows come home, and it's utterly meaningless. If you don't feel confident,
100%,
it's just a word.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean anything. However, what we can all do at any point is to say, however unconfident you're feeling, go in, hold eye contact, smile, and speak up. Everyone can do that.
Mm-hmm.
That's a choice.
Yeah.
We're all capable of doing that.
Yeah.
And if you do that in many, many situations, not only will that help you present yourself as a real top-performing professional, but it should also make you feel a little bit more empowered and in control.
Yeah. And is it just performance, or is it how you dress as well? Is that part of the whole thing?
We don't run the styling course, you'll be pleased to hear, but definitely it's in there. So there's three aspects that we look at. So I've spoken a bit about how you act, which is physical, voice, eyes, body. What you say, which is your language and your words. There is another thing, which is what you do. And one of the things you might do is consider what you're going to wear. So if you walk into a really important interview or meeting, then dress
just
like the person you want to be.
Yeah, I heard dress one level above everybody else in the room, is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. That's contextual.
Yeah.
So obviously you've got to wear what's appropriate for the scenario, but certainly, I mean, to stick on that, there is a really interesting thing. You could argue that I wear a suit to go to work, and that suit is a costume. You know, I put it on in order to go and fulfil my role at work. And interestingly, particularly if you look at the suit is designed to make my shoulders look squarer.
Mm-hmm.
It's designed to help me stand up and look more positive and confident,
mm-hmm,
and in control. And that costume that I put on to work is there to support me. So I know you guys don't wear suits every day when you're out on the course, but you do put your own costume on that's appropriate to work. You probably wear something that's different to go to work than you do when you're hanging out with your mates.
Absolutely, and a lot of our guys these days are invited to board meetings and that sort of thing, and showing up wearing a suit instead of wearing your overalls.
Absolutely.
On the course, make a big
and for
difference.
Us, it's all part of it. It's like an actor wouldn't go to work without having the right costume, and we would say, absolutely, have a think about how are you projecting the right image for you as a professional in your role.
Mm-hmm.
What are you saying? How are you acting? What are you wearing?
Okay, we'll leave that there. Thanks a lot to Mark for taking the time to speak to us. I've never considered how each day we are performing for our managers, our colleagues, and anyone we encounter in our working lives, but every day is a performance, and how you are perceived can have a massive influence on how successful you are in achieving your goals. Next up, myself and Biggar's resident ecology expert, James Hutchinson, made our way down to Sherburn Golf Club in Dorset to meet the entire greenkeeping team, who had also invited along a bunch of members for a course walk. It was a beautiful, sunny day down at the James Braid Design Course. Sherburn was founded in 1894 and offers views over Somerset. In 2000, parts of the course were remodelled and lengthened, while there's a real drive by the team to increase their ecological offering. And I'm happy to say that the members of the club who we met were eager to do their part too. After the course walk, I sat down with greenkeeper Ed Stant and James for a discussion about some of the things we'd seen.
Very informative,
yeah.
Educational. I'm glad the members came out, so it wasn't just the staff seeing what you were doing.
Well, whose idea was it, like, to do it? Was it your idea?
It's my idea.
Yeah, and what made you think you wanted to do it?
Because I like ecology.
Yeah.
And I'm qualified in countryside management, but I just needed like a helping hand to try and get a view across to the greenkeepers and the members, like from a professional person,
yeah,
rather than just me banging on about it, saying, oh, we need this, we need that, we need to do this. Whereas if someone actually came down with a bit more credentials.
Gravitas.
Yeah.
When's he coming?
Yeah, I think about an hour.
Yeah, he's coming when we go. Yeah. So, but you obviously got the members involved. Why did you think that was important?
Because greenkeepers are busy.
Yeah.
And the majority of the members here, 60 plus, they're retired. So I thought if I could get them on board, many hands make work a lot easier.
Yeah, that's a good point. You know what? I was thinking about that when we were out there, that, yeah, a lot of them are retired. If you just say we're having an ecology day, like, people are going to turn out.
Yeah. Also, now that they've heard from James what it's all about, they realise it's not, this is a bit frightening, what is ecology? No, it's just, we need to clear a few areas. You can help us, make it easier for us. And the more you do, the more we get wildflower areas in quicker. So I think they're quite up for having an ecology team.
Yeah.
Maybe headed by me, because I know.
Yeah, someone has to take the lead on it. We were saying that.
I mean, I'm happy to do that.
Yeah.
Because I've got probably the most interest in it and a bit of experience doing it in my last place.
I've seen bat boxes and stuff up. Did you do them?
Yeah.
You put them up?
Yeah. And we've got lots of bird boxes up as well.
Yeah.
Also, the help of my wife. The wildlife vet nurse, she knows what she's talking about, done it for 15 years, so she helps me out with certain things. Potentially, I've always said also potentially a release site, because the RSPCA are always looking for release sites for wildlife.
Yeah.
So,
well, why not? Yeah.
She said, look, if you get bat boxes up, we could potentially bring bats to your area, because we're always looking for areas that are quiet. And I said, well, you can't really get much quieter than golf courses, because come a certain time, it's dead. Plus, being a golf course, like most golf courses, it's a bit of an oasis. Normally, like we are here, we're amongst farms, and the farms are heavily maintained, so you're not going to get badger sets, warrant warrens, and those sort of areas. But here, they're able to thrive.
Yeah.
So if we can, like, make that a bit better, more established, then...
Can I just pick up on what Ed just said then? You mentioned that surrounding areas, farmlands, etc. Golf courses are total havens for wildlife, because you look around a golf course, quite often you'll have a housing estate on one side, a beautiful housing estate, but a housing estate nonetheless, and you've got the farmland to one side, and you might have, I don't know, the sea to the other side. You don't get any wildlife, not much wildlife, in a housing estate. You might get some magpies, rats.
The odd fox.
The odd fox. Cat, squirrel, and that's about it.
Yep.
Farmlands, yes, on the surrounding areas of farmlands, they're quite diverse. You might get yellowhammers, wrens, etc. But it's here on the golf course where all the wildlife resides, and it's the great work that these guys do that encourages wildlife, with the woodland management, wildflowers, and the grassland management that's going to be going on in the next couple of years here. There's certainly going to be more wildlife here. When you look at the surrounding areas, it's all farmlands.
I think also the more you can maybe try and make that aware to the members that this is an oasis, and make them aware. When you leave the golf club, look what's around. How many farms, how many fields are there of nothingness?
Mm. Yeah.
It's crops, but that's not really great for biodiversity. Mm,
absolutely.
Then you come back to here and you think, off the first, huge big sycamore. Oh, there's an oak tree there. Mm. Oh, look at the grassland here. And then make them aware, like those five members, actually, not actually too bad here. There's a few things we need to change, but compared to everywhere around a 50-mile radius, this is a haven, and let's try and work on it, make it better. So they can feel proud themselves that this is a private members club that is environmentally rich. Mm. You could even go down, like you could get schools up here, you could go the whole hog. We've got so many schools around here, so look.
Cool.
Golf courses, it's not just people have this thing of for a golf course you must chemically spray from the entrance to the exit.
Yep.
But actually you come up here, actually you only spray the greens.
Oh, is it?
That's it.
Yeah.
And the greens are a very small area compared to everywhere else.
Can I, James, then, can we move on? You started in the rough just off the first grass.
Mm-hmm.
So why was that an interesting point?
Why was it an interesting point? That's a good question. It was interesting because of the amount of fine grasses that the guys had growing in there.
Mm.
It was also interesting because the potential to lose those grasses over the next 5-10 years or so if they're not managed correctly. And I was telling the guys, if you do cut them, these grasses, and you do leave those grasses lying there, then that's just fertiliser for next season's grasses. Festivals and bents, they don't rye to a certain extent. It's not overly keen on being overly fertilised. So you get your fat grasses coming, your cockswoats, Yorkshire fogs, meadow grasses, etc. That was quite an interesting point, I think, we touched on.
But they're at the same spot that, like, that sort of rough patch and that sort of thing is also where you find wildflowers, right? So what's the balance between, like...
It's finding a balance, what's right for you.
Yeah.
If you've got a scruffy area by the side of a tee, we looked at a scruffy area by the side of a tee, not ideal, but it's an ideal for wildlife. So by managing that area to what you want, i.e. campions, oxeye daisies, some native wildflowers that look absolutely beautiful, you can still have that wildlife, you still have that biodiversity, but it looks attractive, it's scenic, it's aesthetically pleasing. I can't say that word, aesthetically.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Your next bit, you moved on to the Leylandii.
Yes.
So what would you say about that?
As we're speaking in general terms, I see Leylandii on a golf course and they're, let's say, lining a fairway or back of a tee or something. I do suggest to remove them quite simply because they're a dangerous tree on a golf course. They do usually get to a certain age and then they fall over. This is often before they reach maturity because of such shallow rooting, because they're so top heavy.
Yeah.
In terms of wildlife management, wildlife living in them, there's not much at all. You get some bats living in them, which are quite important. You get a few aphids, things like this, but other than that, you don't get much growing in them.
And you can get more from different trees.
Oh yeah. Oak tree, for instance, you get about 360 different organisms will live in an oak tree from January through to December time.
Yep.
Beech is about 200, ash is similar.
Yep.
Sycamore goes down to about 150, and Leylandii is double figures.
Okay.
So not an ideal tree to have. You've got to take into account health and safety as well.
Yeah.
There's a golf course, we've got greenkeepers mowing underneath, golfers passing, so...
Yep, and then there's the big bunding, the sort of mounds that you've built, that sort of thing, which, by the way, is a really good idea to generate a bit of money for the course, isn't it? Because you buy it, you were
the landfill.
You were using it as landfill, that's a brilliant idea. What would you suggest when you see that sort of thing? Because it's quite mowed, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was quite kind of mowed.
Right, well, this is quite amusing. The first question you asked me, I gone to these moundings when I said you've got a lot of fescues in them and you've got the potential to lose them.
Mm.
So I'm going to answer this one the same way. The guys do have a lot of fescue in there, but if they're just cutting it and leaving it there, then it's really not a good thing to do. You need to collect it.
Yeah.
Just fertilise otherwise.
Right. So how often do you cut that, then, mounds?
Once a week.
Once a week? See, I think... Because it's not in play, is it?
It's not meant to be.
It's not meant to be. But I would be right then in saying, James, maybe that you could leave that, could you?
I would suggest leaving around about a third of it, maybe on the top of the mound.
See, that was the original plan.
Yeah.
We were going to cut two or three cups with the rough cutter around the base.
Yeah.
And then we're going to leave the top third to a half as wavy fescue.
Yeah.
But unfortunately we did that, but like I was saying to James, it was the first year of doing it, so it was all thick, tufty grass. We hadn't cut or collected it
yet. Yeah.
So we hadn't been able to thin out the sward, so they didn't see the benefit. So they saw that, lost their ball, complained. So because of that, we had to cut it. It was like a member's bit of peer pressure.
This is another reason why you should have some kind of eco plan. I would suggest that you do leave a third of this. The first year, it's going to look scruffy. You may potentially lose some balls. Second year after management, it's going to be thinner. Third, fourth, fifth years onwards, you're going to have beautiful fine grasses in there.
Right. I was at my last place, and that just rings home because we never had a certain machine to core and collect. But we then got one, and I said to the boss, "You wait, all these complaints of, because we were like a short grassland course, so we had a lot of long rough all around the rock. We didn't have very many trees, just hawthorns and buckthorns. So we had a lot of long rough all around the fairways. And the first few years I was there, literally every day, need to cut this rough down, it's slowing the play down, I can't find my ball. After literally two cuts, we cut it in the autumn and then heavy scarified almost down to the soil in the spring. Literally that summer, we had half the amount of complaints. We then cut it again in the autumn, and then cored and scarified another time in the April. We had a quarter of the complaints. And then the third year, they're saying, God, the course is so nice. It's still wavy grass, but we can see the ball. So it's still a hazard, but we can see the ball straight away. And they loved it. And that was in the space of 3-4 years.
So you need to make that happen here, I suppose.
That's what I'm trying to bang. I'm banging my head against a wall at the moment, but hopefully there's a few little cracks forming.
It takes time.
It
does take time, Here we go. Next, I'm going to ask you about the lichen.
Lichens, fungus,
actually, that was just a good sign. It was just that it was nice.
Healthy. The guys had a collection of map lichens on some of the trees that they had at the top end of the golf course, suggesting that the area's pure up here. These guys don't grow in Manchester, should we say, and London, areas where they're
Alright, cool.
Yeah, basically it's just down there.
And they would start messing about when I start recording. You talk a lot about removing trees.
Yep.
And now that's a good thing. Why would you leave a dead tree on the course then?
A dead tree is more important than a live tree, in my opinion. A lot of people argue it isn't, but in terms of food, sustaining life, then a dead tree is unbelievably important. You've got a group of insects, group of organisms called saprophytic organisms. Okay, so they rely on decaying timber for a portion of their life, whether it's to eat or to hibernate in.
What sort of things are saprophytes?
Well, it actually could be anything. It could be an insect, it could be the bird that relies on decaying timber. So anything that relies, saprophytic organism, anything that relies on decaying timber for a portion of its life. So they are hugely important. Standing timber is even more important than horizontal timber.
Are they safe? Dead trees?
Depends where they are. In a woodland, leave them standing, perfectly fine. Over a green or a tee, or if it's in play, then it's got to be managed. It's got to be managed, taken down. You can monolith them, you just leave a totem pole up. It'll last a lot longer if you do. Take the weight off it. Okay. There's numerous things you can do.
That's interesting.
We used to actually build sculptures in the woodlands and actually put the branches upright. Which is quite nice. So any branch that would fall down in storms or anything, just kept piling it around and get these huge teepees or vertical structures. And the members would say, "What's that?" And I go, "Leave it. It's for the upright upright invertebrates that like it." And they go, "You're joking." And I go, "No. There are certain animals and invertebrates that only like upright timber, like stag beetles, for example."
There you go, you see.
Good knowledge, eh? Do you know that?
No.
No, you didn't.
I've learned something new.
You know anything, yeah. Saprophytes and fungi, and that's it.
Fungi, talk to me about fungi.
Did I miss anything on the second half, on this side?
Oh, you bet. You missed the reason why I'm covered in black, although it's pretty much gone now. This was an ink cap, believe it or not.
A what?
An ink cap.
Is that a fungi?
Yes, fungus, yeah. So, as it's living its life, it starts to eat itself. When it eats itself, it gives off an inky substance, which are where the spores are. So I happened to pick one up and just show everybody, and I'm covered in ink now, but it seems to have gone. Ink caps. We saw a puffball that has an average, or up to 7 trillion individual bits of life in it.
Yeah.
We also saw a fly agaric, and we spoke a little bit about them being hallucinogenic, and Lewis Carroll eating these before he wrote one or two of his plays.
What does it tell you if you see a lot of fungi on the course?
Well, if you see fungi on the course, you know it's a healthy course. So the guys haven't been spraying fungicide all over the place.
Yeah.
Spray fungicide, you kill the fungus off. But if you kill the fungus off, your grasses and your trees aren't going to grow properly.
And you saw the oldest, biggest tree?
Yeah, it's on the 16th. It's the focal point, so the tee is raised.
Yeah.
James got pictures on his phone. And it's a double fairway, so you can see the whole fairway. You've got a beautiful view of Glastonbury Chew on the right.
Yeah.
And when it's all striped up, it looks lovely, because you've got the large perimeter fence of the trees. So come now, they all start going golden and orange. But there's this oak tree right in the middle of the fairway. Mm. You have to either go left or right or go over.
Yeah.
So we went down and had a look at the circumference of it, and it's quite a big one, probably about 200 years plus old.
What's that tree?
Oak tree.
Good old English oak. So the guys are going to measure it around about a metre up.
Yeah.
Measure it all the way around, send me the data in centimetres, and I'll age it for them. But I'm willing to suggest it's 200 upwards, maybe 250, something like that.
Is there anything else that we learned from this that I've missed?
We've learned that a good portion of members are interested in the environment and how their golf courses are managed.
Yeah.
Yes, we only saw 7 here today, but sometimes we could have 50 or 60, 200 turned up at one, I did.
Yeah? Wow.
So I think that is probably quite a niche that greenkeepers don't respect, the fact that there are a lot of greenkeepers here, a lot of members here that have a lot of knowledge that haven't been tapped into. If they just give them a chance, especially in private members clubs, they want to help out on their own course.
Yeah.
Give them a chance.
Yeah.
Get like a eco warrior band together. Get them to do certain things, even if it's like just like trimming some trees or, you know,
raking the clippings up from a small area.
The Green Room Golf Course Podcast is produced by myself, Carl Hansel, on behalf of the British and International Golf Greenkeepers Association. For questions, comments, and concerns, you can get in touch with me by emailing carl@bigger.co.uk. That's Carl with a K. You can also join the conversation on social media using @greenroombigger. And we've also got a Facebook page where all the latest notices, news releases, and information from Bigger can be found. We're also on Instagram using @bigger_HQ. Subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. The more people know about the sports turf industry, the more understanding they will have about the hard work of Bigger members and other greenkeepers. And speaking of Bigger membership, if you're inspired by what you hear to progress your career in greenkeeping, then a major first step is signing up to the association. The opportunities for career development are countless and potentially life-changing, such as volunteer opportunities at major tournaments and educational opportunities across Europe and the USA. Don't forget, if you're a golfer and you've got any questions about anything you hear on the podcast, have a conversation with the greenkeepers at your club. They've got the expertise to explain what's happening at the course and how it fits into the team's long-term vision to improve playability and enjoyment of the facility.